Chapter 8. Jack Summers' first order of business was to shop. He needed clothes, kitchen and bathroom essentials, and apartment furnishings. He had sufficient funds through his Panamanian debit cards, all issued in the name of Eugene Wilson. For a larger purchase, he knew he'd have to open an account at a local bank. Summers set out on Waikiki's main thoroughfare. Fragrances of orchid leis hanging from Kalakaua's sidewalk kiosks mingled with the ocean breezes. Palm trees lined the busy avenue, shading a stream of pedestrians from the morning sun. A river of dawdlers and flip-flops, he thought. Their slow progression would have irritated Jack at some earlier time, but not today. There were no deadlines, no appointments. Life was on temporary standstill. Clothing stores were plentiful on Kalakaua, and Summers needed clothes, but he was also wary of laying out too much money in any one store and becoming a conspicuous consumer who might stick out in some shopkeeper's memory. Buy a little here, buy a little there, he thought. Never too much at one place. Nothing too extravagant. Try not to return to the same place too often. New rules to live by. Summers needed to make room 212 more livable. He bought an assortment of cleaning supplies and spent the afternoon scrubbing down the room. New bedding, new pillows, new pots and pans, and even a new window curtain helped to erase the gritty feeling he'd experienced when he first opened the door. He told Glenn that it would be unnecessary for the housekeeping staff to care for his room, that he would do it himself, thank you very much. Glenn responded, "You're talking to the housekeeping staff, and you're very welcome." The coral reef had no internet service, but the coffee shop around the corner had free Wi-Fi. The library down the block had free Wi-Fi. He could get by. For transportation, a 4-year-old blue Acura in excellent condition was available at a nearby dealership. Summers purchased the car with funds wired from his Panamanian account and titled the car in the name of Eugene Wilson at his Kaiulani Avenue address. His vehicle registration provided him with yet another ID. Things were starting to come together for him, and he was sure it would not be too much longer. He expected to hear good news any day. Dan Gibson, a bundle of nerves since Harrington went missing, received a call from Detective O'Haron. "Did you locate Dennis Harrington?" Dan asked cautiously, fearing the worst.
"Not yet, but we found his car. It was parked at the North Avenue beach."
"At the beach? Why would it be at the beach?" O'Haron paused.
"We saw no indication of foul play. There may be all sorts of explanations. All we know is that his car was left in the lot at North Avenue. It was snow-covered and locked. We had a tow to the pound of Randolph. I just thought I'd let you know. If you have a key, you can come and pick it up."
"Will you keep looking for Dan? Will you canvass the area?"
"The immediate area is vacant, snow-covered beach. We did take a look around, but we didn't see anything. If you're talking about canvassing the people who live in the high-rises across Lakeshore Drive, no, sir, we do not intend to do that, but we'll keep his MP file open."
"Is it against the law for me to post signs in the area? You know, like, call me if you have information?"
"I don't see the harm, sir."
Jenkins hurriedly assembled his firm's executive board. The email was short and to the point. "Emergency meeting in the conference room, 2 p.m. Serious situation, no excuses."
"Who owns this loan services account?"
a partner asked after Gil had narrated his story.
"We don't know yet," Gil said. "I've requested all the information from Exchange. It should be here soon."
"Who's at fault here, Walter?" another partner said. "Is this our fuck-up?"
Jenkins gestured for Gil to answer.
"I hate to keep saying this, Preston," Gil said, "but we don't know yet. There may be several explanations for the missing funds." He counted them off on his fingers. "One, the money may in fact be sitting at the bank and the bank is wrong. They'll find their error and straighten it out. Hell, it might be a firestorm over nothing. 2, there could be some glitch in the internet transfer and the Fed wire was never completed. Maybe the money is still in transit, in limbo somewhere. It's happened before." Gil looked around the room. "Either one of these would solve the problem." He shrugged. 3, maybe it's Exchange's fault. Maybe Greta signed more than one letter.
Gil continued. Or somewhere between Greta and Midwestern, the document was corrupted by a third party. He shrugged again. Could be.
I thought you said that Harrington and Summers signed off on the letter, Preston said. They both eyeballed and approved the goddamn letter.
Gil nodded. That's true. I'm sorry, I guess we can forget about number three. He held up four fingers. Still, someone at Midwestern Title could have changed the numbers after the letter was approved by Summers. I doubt it was Ellis, I've known him for a few years, but I guess you can't exclude anyone. Also, it's possible someone got into his file cabinet. Maybe another officer at Midwestern. Five, Harrington could have changed the numbers and slipped it by Summers at the closing. Six, I guess you all know what's coming. Summers and Harrington could have jointly participated in a monstrous embezzlement. They're both missing. Gil looked around the room. I recommend we notify our liability insurance carrier immediately.
What are the limits of our policy? A partner asked.
50 million, Jenkins said.
So we could be holding the bag for $38 million?
Jenkins nodded.
That's true. If we're found to be at fault, if it was stolen by one of our partners, or through the firm's negligence, this partnership and every partner here could be liable for $38 million.
Shouldn't we also notify the FBI?
Just then, Jenkins' secretary entered the room with an email from Exchange and handed it to Jenkins. He read it and closed his eyes. He dropped the note on the table where Gil retrieved it and read it to the group.
Wire transfer for $88 million received yesterday by the New York branch of Exchange National to be credited to the account of Loan Services Company. The account was opened by Richard Hudson, president of Loan Services Company, on December 20th with an initial deposit of $1,000. At 10:30 a.m. within minutes of the receipt of yesterday's wire transfer, Mr. Hudson directed Exchange to immediately wire transfer the entire balance to the First Republic Bank, Panama City, Republic of Panama, to be credited to the account of Capital Investment Funds, Inc., account number 14-96124-5444. Transfer was completed at 10:45 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. The account was then closed. It appears that neither Mr. Hudson's telephone number nor his address is valid. Duplicate copies of the documentation to follow.
There was silence in the room. The partners looked around, hoping that someone would offer up an answer, a solution.
Does anyone know anything about this bank in Panama?
Jenkins said.
I've never dealt with the First Republic Bank, but I've done business with other Panama banks, a partner responded. They're the second largest international banking center in the world, next to Switzerland. There are over 100 international banks in Panama, with the tightest banking secrecy laws in the world. Panama law prohibits bankers from disclosing any information about a private banking client to any person, including the United States government. Panama has enacted severe penalties for any violations. Accounts are easy to set up. You can do it from anywhere. You don't have to be in Panama. All you need is two financial reference letters from banks or brokerage houses bearing a notary stamp, the kind that every secretary in our office has sitting in her desk drawer. You also need a passport, but they'll accept a photocopy. The documents are rarely, if ever, verified, especially if no credit is requested.
Jenkins stood.
Enough. Susan, contact our insurance carrier and put them on notice of a possible claim. Gil, contact Tom Tryon at the U.S. Attorney's Office and schedule a meeting.
I'm going to contact a very good private investigator I know.
Everyone rose to leave.
I don't have to tell any of you, Jenkins said, that none of this information leaves this room. If it hits the street, it could ruin us. As of this time, our position is and will remain that we have done absolutely nothing wrong.
Summers turned in early. The last few days had frayed his nerves, and he was exhausted, mentally and physically. He poured himself a small glass of scotch from a bottle he kept within reach on the nightstand. Although he dozed off quickly, his sleep was fitful, beset by the same disturbing dreams. There he was,
back again at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, standing by Alina. Her beautiful olive complexion had paled. She'd lost so much weight. He stood frozen by her bedside. Everything he loved was slipping away, and he could do nothing to stop it. Totally helpless. Totally useless. Alina looked up from her bed and smiled weakly at him.
"Take care of our little butterfly," she said in a whisper. "Promise me you'll take care of her, Jack. Don't let her forget me."
"Alina," he pleaded, "stop. You're going to be fine. The doctors are treating you. They'll cure you. They said they're hopeful."
"I love you, Jack. I've loved you since the day I met you."
She smiled and reached for his hand.
"Remember that first day? I was playing the piano. You were wearing a tux. You were so handsome."
He tried to grasp her hand, to lean over the bed, but the rail kept rising higher and higher, blocking him, separating him, keeping him back. Alina withdrew farther and farther from his reach.
"Jack, stay strong. For me. For Sophie. For yourself. Remember our wedding vows. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee."
Then, in a whisper,
"Jack, it's time. I have to go now."
"No. It's not time, not yet. Stay with me, Alina. You know I can't. I don't want to be without you." She raised her hand and smiled.
"But you have to."
He grabbed the bars of her bed rail. "Stay with me, please. Keep fighting. Sophie and I need you."
"I can't fight anymore, sweetheart. I've tried. Now I have to leave. From time to time, show Sophie my picture. Tell her that her mother loved her very much."
"Alina!" he cried. "Wait! Let me call Dr. Stone!" He frantically tried to dial the doctor's number, but the phone kept slipping from his hands. He looked down at Alina. She was fading in and out of focus.
"Take care of Sophie. She needs you now. You must stay strong for her. Goodbye, my love."
Alina's eyes closed, and the bed was suddenly empty. He woke up in a sweat.
"No!"
he yelled. He reached for the scotch, poured another shot, downed it, and flung the glass into the wall.
"Alina!"
he screamed. It was 4 a.m., but Summers needed to get out of the room. He grabbed his sweater and left the motel. The ocean breeze had cooled the night air. His walk was aimless, just one block and then the next, and soon he found himself back on Kalakaua, wiping away the tears that wouldn't stop. The beachfront hotels were dark and quiet. Just past the Hyatt, he came upon Kuhio Beach Park, where he took a seat on a wooden bench. The bright gibbous moon reflected off the calm seas. Soon it would be dawn. His dreams of Alina had shaken him to the core. They were a clarion reminder of his abject failures. He had failed to keep his promise. He had failed Alina. He had failed Sophie. Summers felt as if every single internal organ was tied in a knot. He stared at the sea. Calm, dark, peaceful. "Come join me," it said. "I offer peace." He stood and let the vast sea reel him closer.
"Alina, I'm so lost," he said to himself. "I've made such a mess of things. I'm falling apart, honey. Sometimes it's even hard for me to take a breath."
The water echoed,
"Come join me."
In numbing obedience, he walked slowly into the shallows and watched the waves softly lap over his sandals and splash against his knees.
"Don't you see, Alina? I'm not as strong as you thought I was. I was only strong because of you. Can't you help me?
The sudden brash call of a seagull raised his eyes to the night sky. He took a deep breath and nodded. He looked back at the black water and gave it a swift kick.
I know, I know. Get a grip, Jack. There's a job to do.
Walking back to the motel, he took determined steps.
I can't continue to wallow in this sadness. It doesn't do any of us any good. Have faith in me, Lena. I made you a promise and I won't let you down. I've worked out a plan and I'm going to see it through. I'm sure word will come soon. I'm going to get her back, sweetheart. I promise you.
Chapter 9. Liam Taggart walked up the steps of his fiancée's three-story brownstone in the Lincoln Park section of Chicago, put his key in the lock, and entered the foyer. He shook the snow from his coat and hat and brushed the slush from the cuffs of his trousers.
Liam, you're getting snow all over my floor, Catherine said as she hurried to meet him in the hall. Take your shoes off.
I'm sorry, it's really coming down out there. You should see the drive.
I know, I just got in myself.
She took his coat and hung it on the foyer rack.
Almost as tall as Liam, Catherine Lockhart brushed her blonde hair back from her face and leaned over to give him a kiss. She was comfortably dressed in her jeans and a blue cable-knit sweater.
I'll clean it up, Liam said. I want your Aunt Edna getting mad at me.
Catherine handed him a towel. I talked to Aunt Edna today. She says it's 84 degrees in West Palm.
Oh, that's unkind. Tell her to come home, we'll trade places.
I don't think she's ever coming back. She loves it down there. She said she wants to give me this house.
Whoa, that's quite a gift.
She shook her head. I can't accept it. It's worth $1 million or more. I told her that.
Liam finished wiping the floor and carried the towel back to the laundry room.
And what did she say?
She said it would be a good place to raise my family.
Liam raised his eyebrows.
Does she know something I don't know?
Very funny.
Catherine turned and walked to the refrigerator and took out two beers.
She says I'm not getting any younger.
Catherine handed a bottle to Liam.
She's right, you know. Next month I'll be 37. It's getting late to start a family.
Is that a proposal?
Is that what you think?
Catherine put her hands on her hips.
Let me tell you, I'd be a lot more romantic than that if I were going to propose. When the time is right, I want it done with ceremony, pomp, and circumstance, not some off-the-cuff remark.
Excuse me?
I'll remember that when the time is right.
She turned and walked back to the kitchen, repeating, "When the time is right," under her breath.
Cat? Something wrong?
No.
Cat!
Don't worry about it. Tell me about your day.
Extraordinary. You'll never guess who came to see me today.
She shrugged. I give up.
Walter Jenkins, of all people. He called for an appointment and came right over before I could tell him no. He wants to hire me.
I hope you told him to get lost.
Liam smiled and bit his bottom lip.
I didn't. I listened to his story, and it was a whopper.
Another problem with one of his precious insurance clients?
Still smiling, Liam opened his eyes widely and shook his head.
Nope. A disaster of nuclear proportions.
He told me I could share it with you.
He thinks he may want to hire you as well.
Catherine pursed her lips.
Hire me? The unprincipled bastard fired me last year and then tried to bribe me to drop my client.
She put her hands on her hips.
I wouldn't work for him under any circumstances. Not if he ran the last law firm in Chicago.
Liam smiled.
He regrets his conduct.
Only because it now suits his convenience. He wants to hire my boyfriend. Are you seriously going to take this assignment? He's a pompous, self-absorbed, unethical bastard.
Calm down. I told him I'd think about it and discuss it with you. If you said it would make you uncomfortable, I'd have to decline.
He was okay with that. That's why he told me that it was all right to disclose the case to you, but you'd have to swear an oath of secrecy.
He raised his eyebrows. It's a whopper, Cat. He'll give me a $50,000 retainer.
Catherine whistled. 50 grand for Mr. Tightwad?
Liam took a seat in the overstuffed chair by the fireplace. Catherine curled up on the corner of the couch and tucked her feet under her like a young girl. Liam smiled lovingly at her. Her ability to enchant him had been unwavering for 20 years.
Regale me, she said.
Liam repeated the information Jenkins had laid out earlier in the day.
And he wants you to find Summers? Catherine said.
He wants me to find the money. He's not sure Summers has it.
I barely knew Summers when I was at the firm. I remember him as a sad and troubled man, but not the kind who would steal $80 million.
88, Liam corrected. What do you know about Summers?
Not much. He was a transactional attorney who handled purchases and sales of businesses, asset purchases, stock purchases, mergers, acquisitions. He was kind of lanky, not bad-looking, with a lot of brown hair. A nice guy, quiet, unassuming. Everyone seemed to get along with him. He was married to a very sweet woman. She was Middle Eastern, I think. He was completely devoted to her. They had one child, a cute little girl. A couple of years ago, his wife contracted a fatal illness that took her very rapidly. He was devastated.
Liam nodded his head slowly.
I can see why you say he was sad and troubled. There was more. A custody dispute with his wife's parents or something. I really don't know the details. That was about the time I left the firm.
So?
What do you think? Liam said.
About the assignment.
It's a whopper, all right. And I'm not going to tell you to pass up a $50,000 retainer. But what makes him want to involve me?
Unless the money turns up immediately, he's sure that Kelson will file suit. He needs a good lawyer.
He has a firm full of lawyers. Good ones. And his malpractice insurance company will provide lawyers.
He's got to have an independent lawyer. He can't assign any lawyers from his firm when they could all wind up being defendants in a suit for the deficiency. He has to have private counsel in addition to the insurance lawyers.
He told me that you're the best attorney he knows.
Liam spread his hands.
He thinks it's logical to have us work together like we did with Ben Solomon. He was really impressed.
Yeah, he was so impressed he fired me.
Seriously, he spent several minutes reminiscing about Ben's case. He stands there, punctuating with his index finger and says, "She takes up the case of an old man, a pensioner with no money, and sues the wealthiest man in Chicago. Not only does she sue him, but she accuses him of being a Nazi. A Nazi, for Christ's sake!"
Then he walks around the room shaking his head.
"I thought she was nuts. Elliot Rosenzweig, a Nazi? He's the biggest Jewish benefactor in the city. The lawsuit almost puts me out of business. I beg her to drop it. I even offer her financial motivation, but she tells me to stuff it and walks out. Then she proceeds to litigate the case on her own out of her house. With your help, naturally. Jesus, Liam, that's got to be the best lawyering Chicago's ever seen."
Catherine smiles.
Financial motivation. That's funny. Most of us would call it a bribe. What about this loan services company? What did they find out?
It's a Delaware corporation owned entirely by a man named Robert Hudson and formed 7 weeks ago. Victor Kelson says he never heard of it, or anyone named Hudson.
It's probably a shell company formed to accomplish the theft.
Will Jenkins hire you even if I refuse to accept his offer?
Liam nodded. He said he would understand if he didn't want to represent him, but he would hire me anyway.
Then tell him I said, piss off.
Chapter 10. Another afternoon, and another check of his secret email address results in further disappointment for Summers. Days come and days go, and still there is no word. No new messages. He posts, "How are the plans progressing? When can I expect to hear something? I am anxiously awaiting your response." He clicks send and stares at the computer screen. He commands the screen to answer him, but it doesn't respond. His entire life is on hold. The inactivity is becoming insufferable. Summers closes his computer and walks slowly back to the coral reef. "I can't face another afternoon in this motel room," he thinks. "I've got to get out.
I've got to do something or I'll go mad.
A page in a Hawaii travel brochure provides a suggestion. Take a scenic drive to Oahu's friendly North Shore. A picture of a restaurant looks appealing. It's a long ride, but Summers thinks it might take his mind off his gridlock. With the sunroof open and the windows down, Summers heads west on Interstate H1, past Pearl Harbor, Hickam Field, and Aloha Stadium. It is the archetypal Hawaiian day, with temperatures in the mid-80s. Trade winds carry a melange of tropical fragrances through the open windows. He motors north onto H2 toward Wahiawa, the North Shore, and the travel brochure's destination, the artsy town of Hale'iwa. He glides past pineapple plantations and sugarcane fields, but his mind predictably wanders back to Alina, Sophie, and happier times. He had just walked in the door and Alina was calling to him from the living room.
"Jack," she said excitedly. "Sophie has something special to show you."
She took his hand and pointed to Sophie, who sat poised at the piano. The little 4-year-old, a pink ribbon tied in her blonde curls, sat on a booster seat that Alina had strapped to the piano bench. A big smile stretched across Sophie's face in anticipation. Alina nodded to Sophie. Sophie stretched her fingers the way she had seen her mother do so many times and lit into a lively rondo. She attacked the keys with astonishing maturity. Jack clapped loudly and urged her to repeat the selection. And then again.
"How could a 4-year-old play that well?" he said.
Sophie giggled.
"She's special, Jack," Alina whispered to him. "I know you'll say I'm biased, but I've been around the other kids. Sophie has extraordinary talent. Someday, she'll change the world."
Jack laughed.
"Alina, she's only 4.
You mark my words. With Sophie, the sky's the limit."
Turning onto Highway 99 and lost in his memories, Jack's reverie was shattered by the lights of a highway patrol car. A knot formed in the pit of his stomach, and sweat beaded on the band of his Panama hat. He checked his speed. 73. "Damn. What a fool I am. This is the last thing I need. What if this cop figures out I'm not Eugene? What if there's an interstate warrant? If he arrests me, I'll have come all this way only to fail again. All because of a damn speeding ticket." The uniformed officer stepped out of his squad car and slowly walked up behind the Acura. He looked at the license applied for sticker in the back window.
"May I see your license and registration, please?"
With a shaking hand, Summers reached into his wallet, took out the driver's license, and handed it to the patrolman with a copy of the receipt for his new vehicle registration. He thought the beating of his heart would break his ribs.
"Was I speeding, officer?"
"Oh, yeah. I clocked you at 72 and a 55.
"I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention to my speed."
Summers hoped the officer would just write the ticket and not investigate beyond the plates. The patrolman carefully looked over the interior of the car.
"Visiting from Kentucky, Mr. Wilson?"
Actually, I'm here for an extended time, doing work for a client."
He swallowed hard, fearing the worst. A trip to the police station. The officer shook his head and grinned.
"I know it's pretty quiet out here today, Mr. Wilson, but you never know. One of these farmers will drive out of a little gravel road. You wouldn't see him until it was too late. Take it easy, huh?"
The officer handed back the license and registration.
"Have a nice day."
Summers was flabbergasted.
"You're giving me a warning? You're not going to give me a ticket?"
"Not unless you want one."
The officer tipped the brim of his cap and turned back to his car.
"We'll chalk it up to the Aloha spirit."
"Thank you very much," Summers called after him. The officer smiled and nodded. Summers, his heart still beating loudly, sat in his car and waved as the police officer drove past him.
"I'm sorry, Alina. It won't happen again."
He drove slowly the rest of the way to Hale'iwa and pulled into the parking lot of McDuffie's by the Sea, a rustic wooden restaurant with a large outdoor patio sheltered by 2 banyan trees. Summers walked straight past the outdoor tables, up the steps, and directly to the bar. Sitting on a stool, he ordered a double and drank it quickly.
He took deep breaths.
You okay?
The bartender said.
No, I am.
Wooden blades of the overhead fan circulated the heavy sea air. Summers ordered another drink. He was beginning to relax. Suddenly, a woman's voice startled him.
Jack? Jack Summers? What the hell?
He spun around, looked directly into a familiar face, and breathed a sigh of relief.
Marcy. What a surprise.
Marcy greeted Jack with a hug. She was dressed for a day in the sun, khaki shorts, a sleeveless shirt, and leather sandals. Jack had always thought that Providence had a tomboy in mind when she put Marcy Grant together, giving her more straight lines than curves on her small athletic body. But there was no denying her fair and gentle face, softly framed by rich auburn hair. A blue cotton overshirt was tied around her shoulders. Her thick hair, streaked by the sun, was pulled back in a loose ponytail. A Nikon SLR digital camera hung from a strap around her neck. She placed her camera on the bar and took a seat on the adjoining stool.
What are you doing out in Hawaii?
She said. It's just a stopover, only for a day or so. I'm on a business trip.
Why didn't you call me?
To tell you the truth, I totally forgot you were out here. She feigned a pout.
Oh, thanks a lot.
I'm sorry. It's been a crazy few months. She smiled and gave him another spontaneous hug.
I'm so happy to see you. I think about you and Alina all the time. Is your business here on the North Shore?
No, it's in Honolulu. But I've been under a lot of stress, so I decided to take the afternoon off and go for a relaxing ride. It didn't work.
Why not? You couldn't ask for a prettier day, and you came to the best side of the island.
So I've heard. But I got pulled over by the highway patrol. Marcy laughed heartily. Summers chuckled as well. But he let me go. Summers laughed a little harder. He gave me a warning. Tipped his cap. Called it the Aloha Spirit.
That's never happened to me. They never do that. You're as lucky as a Minihuni.
It occurred to Summers that he had just laughed. And he tried to think of the last time he thought anything was funny.
I cannot remember, he said aloud to himself.
Marcy was puzzled.
Remember what?
He shook his head. Never mind. It was really nice to see you, Marcy.
That's it? It was nice to see you? Not even, do you have time for a drink?
I'm sorry, my mind is somewhere else.
Of course, I'd love to have a drink.
He signaled to the bartender.
Gosh.
She swiveled on her chair.
Jack Summers, I haven't seen you since, Jesus, since the funeral. Have you been getting along?
Summers tilted his head this way and that.
Not so good, Marcy.
It's been real hard. Listen, can I ask you a big favor? Can we keep my trip out here just between the two of us? Would you mind not telling anyone that you've seen me? You know, don't text anyone, call anyone. Please, don't put it on Facebook, okay? What I'm doing here is pretty private. Really, I don't want anyone to know. She bit her bottom lip in a conspiratorial smile.
Are you back with the State Department?
Summers smiled and patted her on the leg.
I can't even tell you that. I shouldn't even be socializing.
Oh, what bullshit. We've known each other for 10 years. Ever since Alina and I met at the Shakespeare Theater. Stay for dinner. Food's great here. I'm buying.
She called the bartender over.
Derek, another round for my Chicago friend and a mug of my usual.
Jack had another tumbler of vodka, which Derek poured generously. Marcy had a tangerine wheat beer and a frosted mug.
So, what are you doing out on this side of the island with a camera around your neck?
Jack said.
I live out here, in Haleiwa. You remember after Ted and I split I had to leave Chicago? He wouldn't let me alone. He was stalking me, for Christ's sake.
Alina must have filled you in. Jack acknowledged the memory with a nod.
So I came out here to start a photography career.
Right.
I remember you were into photography. How's it going?
She laughed. Shitty. I can't get my pictures into the magazines. That's where the money is. It's a real homeboy network in Hawaii. I can't get past the front door. But I'm selling pictures at the hotels and in art shows, and that pays the bills most of the time. It's a real change in lifestyle.
Well, you don't look any worse for the wear.
Thanks. You look pretty good yourself. So, did you come out here with Sophie? How is my little darling?
Jack smiled with tightly closed lips and nodded. She's great. Debbie's watching her while I'm here on my assignment.
Oh, I'm sorry you didn't bring her. I'd have watched her. I've loved that little imp since the day she was born. You tell her that her Aunt Marcy misses her a bunch and wants to give her a big hug.
Summers' eyes misted, and he turned his head.
What's wrong, Jack?
He shook his head. Just memories, Marcy. She reached over and put her arm around his shoulder.
Let's get a bite to eat.
They waited for a table on the lanai and ordered another cocktail. Conversation centered on better days back in Chicago and the escapades of their social group. By the time dinner was served, Jack was starting to lose his equilibrium. He finished his mahi-mahi, ordered dessert and an after-dinner cordial. Beyond that, he would have no memory of the balance of the evening. Jack awoke the next morning on a double bed, in white cotton sheets with embroidered edges and feather pillows, clothed only in his boxers. The windows were open to the sea air, and the smell of coffee permeated the bedroom. He sat up, his head thick and heavy, a painful reminder of the night before. What the hell did I do? He stood, balanced himself, and located his pants, which were lying in a rumpled heap on the floor next to his shirt and socks. On unsteady legs, he followed the aroma of fresh-brewed coffee to the kitchen. He found cups in a cabinet and began to pour, then spotted a copy of a lawsuit lying on the counter. Pacific Properties, Inc. versus Marcy Grant. He picked it up, read through it, shook his head and placed it back where he found it. Then he refilled his cup and walked out to the porch. In a t-shirt and running shorts, cross-legged on a cushioned glider, Marcy sat holding a mug of coffee and reading the morning paper. Bougainvilleas in reds, pinks, and purples splashed their colors on trellises around her patio. Gentle morning breezes, precursors to the afternoon trade winds, carried sweet floral fragrances. Music played softly on a stereo. Very pretty, he said, smiling. What smells so nice?
Plumeria. She pointed to a five-petaled flower. Its fragrance peaks in the morning. It's the scent most people associate with Hawaii.
He pulled up a patio chair. Marcy, I'm really sorry about last night. I didn't
know you didn't. No matter what you're gonna say, you didn't do anything other than have a few too many. I certainly couldn't let you drive. You passed out as soon as we got in the door.
As he tried again to stumble through an apology, she held up her hand to cut him off.
Why don't you finish your coffee and I'll drive you to your car?
Jack sensed the change in her demeanor, a sudden chill. He looked quizzically at her. Did I say something wrong last night? Did I do something wrong, offend you in some way? She shrugged.
You pay the check with Gene Wilson's credit card. You're out here masquerading as your brother-in-law? What are you doing with Gene's identification and credit cards? I'm sure it's not State Department policy to use a family member's IDs. And you don't want me to tell anyone you're here. This isn't just some stopover. What's going on? If I call Debbie, what would she say?
Listen, Marcy, you can't call Debbie. You can't call anyone. You promised. Please, trust me. If you ever loved Alina and me...
What do you mean, ever loved? Marcy snapped. What kind of thing is that to say?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean it like that. I just need for you to believe I'm doing the right thing and honor my request. Please.
Marcy pursed her lips and gave a couple of shakes of her head. I won't tell anybody, Jack, but I need for you to believe in me.
Someday you'll understand. Please. She nodded. I should leave now. I don't think it's a good idea for us to hang out.
I don't like this, Jack, whatever you're up to. For your sake and Sophie's and because of my love for Alina, I won't tell anyone I've seen you. But if you need something, if you're in trouble, you can call me. Maybe I can help.
Jack hung his head. I'm sorry, Marcy. Not this time. It's for your own good.
She set the paper down and grabbed her car keys. You know I'd have done anything for Alina. That was the saddest day of my life, Jack. And I'd do anything for you and Sophie. Call me when you need me.
Jack swallowed hard and walked with her to the car. I want you to know that before I made a fool of myself last night, I was having a nice time. A really good time. For the first time in many months. Like the old days.
Thanks, sweetie. Me too.
As she pulled into the lot, he started to say something else, then stopped. Goodbye, Marcy. Chapter 11. Yet another basketball game on the road to the NCAA tournament, and the Deacons led Midland State by 14 at the half. The Saturday afternoon game was just weeks before Selection Sunday. Kelson turned to the man beside him and said,
"No contest, George. I thought it'd be closer, but I guess those Vegas guys know what they're talking about, setting a 21-point spread."
"I stayed away from this game, Vic. Laying 21 points against a ranked team is suicide. Did you lay the points?"
Kelson smiled and shrugged. George laughed.
"As always, the inscrutable Mr. Kelson never discloses his positions."
"Right." The second half saw the Deacons' comfortable lead teeter between 18 and 22 points. With the clock running down and the Deacons ahead by 20, Marcus Field stole the inbounds pass from Midland State and broke toward the basket all alone. His attempt at a two-handed slam hit hard off the back of the rim and bounded out to midcourt. Midland's point guard grabbed it and laid it in as the buzzer sounded. Final score, St. Joe's 87, Midland State 69.
"What the hell?"
George said.
"That was an easy bucket for Fields. He was unguarded. Would have won by 22, totally blew the point spread. How the hell does he slam it off the iron?"
Vic stood and put on his coat.
"Overly excited, I guess. What's the difference? They won big."
"Big is right if you took the points."
George gave Kelson an inquisitive smile.
"Did you, Vic?"
"Good night, George."
Sophie stood by herself in the corner of the playground as she did each recess. She watched as the other children played on the equipment. A line was forming to go on the slide, but she did not move. One swing was empty, and Sophie liked to swing, but she didn't stray from her corner. One game looked like tag, but the children were yelling words that Sophie couldn't understand. So she watched, as she did each day.
"My name is Jamila,"
said a voice behind her. Sophie turned and saw a girl just about her size smiling at her. Sophie timidly returned the smile.
"My mother is from India, so I can talk in English. Did you just move to Hebron?"
Sophie nodded.
"Do you have friends?"
Sophie shook her head slowly.
"I could be your friend."
Sophie smiled.
"Teacher said your name is Safiya?"
Sophie giggled.
"It's Sophie. Safiya is my aunt. I love to paint. Do you like to paint?"
Sophie nodded enthusiastically.
"Would you like to come to my house after school someday? I can ask my mother."
The smile broadened on Sophie's face.
"I would."
Catherine finished the last of her scheduled appointments at 4 p.m., She walked with her client, an elderly man in a tweed sport coat, into her small reception area. In stark contrast to the posh surroundings she used to enjoy at Jenkins and Fairchild, she now ran her solo practice from a small storefront on Clark Street, north of Diversey. Small, but cozy, much to her satisfaction.
"Remember to bring your estate planning questionnaire with you when you come next time,"
she said to her client, who sat on a chair putting on his rubber boots. Be sure to list all your assets, name all your heirs, and write out any special bequests. The old man smiled as he reached for the doorknob and said, Where there's a will, there's a way. Catherine smiled, picked up her phone messages, and returned to her office. Shortly thereafter, a smartly dressed man stepped out of a taxi. His camel cashmere coat covered a blue Armani suit, complemented with a purple Brioni tie and contrasting pocket square. He was careful to keep his Italian shoes away from the curbside slush. After pausing for a moment to look at the door, which read, Offices of Catherine Lockhart, Attorney at Law, he entered and asked the secretary if Catherine was available.
Do you have an appointment, sir? I don't have anyone else scheduled to see her this afternoon, said the young woman.
No, I don't. But would you please ask her if she could spare a few minutes for Walter Jenkins?
The secretary walked back to Catherine's office.
Cat, you'll never guess who's in the waiting room.
Catherine looked up from her work, brushed her hair from the side of her face, and shrugged.
I give up, Gladys.
The secretary put her hands on her hips and wiggled in a snooty manner.
Mr. Walter Jenkins, Esquire, that's who. I do believe he was your old boss, and now he asks, ever so politely, if you could spare him a few minutes.
Gladys raised her eyebrows.
How about them apples? Should I shoo him away or show him in?
Catherine leaned back in her chair. Jenkins came down to my office? Gladys nodded sharply.
Yep, in the snow. What do you suppose he wants?
I have no idea. Bring him up. Gladys took Jenkins' coat, offered him a glass of water, and walked him from the reception room back to Catherine's office. Catherine came around her desk to shake his hand.
How have you been, Walter?
So-so.
Jenkins took a moment to survey her office. He smiled.
Same old Catherine. Papers everywhere. Empty coffee cups.
He nodded.
You're looking good, Catherine.
Thanks. Things are going well.
Catherine motioned for him to have a seat and returned to her desk chair.
I guess you've heard. We've been scammed. Someone embezzled $88 million from a corporate deal we were handling. J&F is on the hook for almost 40 of it. Never saw it coming from these guys.
Do you know where the money is? Who took it?
Jenkins shook his head.
No proof how it was done or who did it. Summers was the man in charge. They tell me that the money's now in Panama in some untouchable bank.
Why didn't you call before you came over here? I would have told you.
You would have told me not to bother. You would have told me you're not interested. You would have told me that you have no experience in matters like this. You would have told me that there's no way you would work for an asshole like Walter Jenkins.
That's exactly what I would have said to you. Except I would have had the civility not to call you an asshole.
Jenkins sat back in his chair, smoothed his trousers, and crossed his legs. He looked calm and in control, but at the same time sad and embarrassed. He spoke quietly.
I need you, Catherine. I realize we ended badly, but I have to go outside the firm. And you're the best lawyer I know.
Let's be honest. You're here because you don't want to hire any of the prominent firms in the city. You can't afford to air your dirty laundry. You don't want your competitors snooping around inside your office. You certainly don't want to give them on-the-street gossip material. You're afraid they'll raid your client base, fragment your firm, and J&F will fold like Montague, Post, and Evans did last year. You're looking for a strong litigator outside the Loop establishment.
Jenkins bit his lip and nodded slowly.
For argument's sake, let's say you're correct. Can I hire you?
No. I'd never work for an asshole like Walter Jenkins.
He sat up straight and furrowed his brow.
Seriously?
Catherine smiled.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. I've been waiting to say that to you for more than a year.
Has suit been filed?
Not yet, but it's coming. No doubt about it. Kelson won't return my calls.
Jenkins shook his head.
I guess you know we hired Liam. You two work so well together, I just think it's a natural package. I get a great lawyer and a great PI. Will you at least consider it? Please.
I'll think about it. Call me after you get served at the lawsuit. No promises, but I'll take a look at the case.
Catherine stood.
If I do decide to represent J&F, I'd want full cooperation and full access to the system of all the partners and the J&F staff. No restrictions. Nothing held back. I need support. Secretarial, paralegal, and a good associate. Someone like Rob Hemmer. And I'd want senior partner rates. $750 an hour. Jenkins stood and held out his hand.
You can have Hemmer. Anything you need. Money will not be an issue. You'll have our full cooperation.
I'll think about it. Let me know when you get served.
Chapter 12.
Summers merged into the noontime stream of pedestrians walking along Kalakaua. Waikiki's arterial vein was full of midday energy. The breeze was light, and the sun beamed hot upon his skin. Dressed in sandals, shorts, a light blue golf shirt, dark sunglasses, and a U of H cap, he felt more secure walking in public without fear of recognition. As Milani had described it, he was melting into the population. At Luer Street, Summers took a turn onto Kalia Road. He knew where he had to go and what he had to face. Since arriving in Honolulu, he'd stayed away. But his yesterdays were beckoning to him, and he wanted to know what they had to say. At the end of Kalia, he reached the Hilton Hawaiian Village and its shops, pools, and expansive crescent beach. Bittersweet memories carried him along the winding pathway, past the kidney-shaped pool, past the sunbathers and the children squealing in the water. Next to the beach was an outdoor cafe, where Summers took a seat. He shut his eyes and allowed the sounds and smells to take him back to earlier times when life was sweet, before his world imploded. He prayed that when he opened his eyes, it would be 3 years ago. Alina would step out of the pool, grab a towel and come to him, her brilliant smile lighting up all of Waikiki.
"Can I get you something, sir?"
the waitress said, resting him from his daydream. She set a glass of ice water on the table.
"There are three of us," he said with a knot in his throat. "Please bring us two Mai Tais and a fruit juice. And they all must have purple umbrellas."
She nodded and left to fill the order.
"Damn. I'm a prisoner in the present. I don't want to be here. I don't have the strength to be here. I want to open my eyes and find out that the last 2 years were nothing but a bad dream."
Without waiting for the drinks, he stood, left money on the table, and walked past the rainbow tower to the beach. He stared intently at a spot where the ocean met the sand. Again, he saw only his memories. Sandals in hand, he walked across the hot sand to stand in the shallow water. He looked down at Sophie, sitting with her plastic bucket and shovel. He looked back to the sand to see Alina on a beach chair reading her magazine. Images that quickly dissolved. Tears rolled down his cheeks.
"God," his mind shouted. "Are you listening to me? Because it's time for you and me to have it out, right now, right here. Why did you do this to us? Come on, I want answers. Alina always told me that everything happened for a reason. There was a purpose in the universe, okay? What's the purpose? What possible reason could you have for destroying my family? What's your grand plan? You took my wife. You've stolen my daughter. You've reduced me to a common thief. I've lost everything I had, including my self-respect. Are you happy now? Does this suit your grand plan? And my little daughter, she's just a baby. Why would you do this to her?"
He dropped to his knees in the surf and wept convulsively.
"Please, please, God, help me get my daughter back. She doesn't deserve this. I need your help."
A man came up to him and bent over.
"Are you all right, fella? Do you need me to call someone? Get you some assistance?"
Summers splashed water on his face and stood.
"No. No, I'm okay, thanks. Really, I'll be all right.
He walked out of the surf toward the hotel lobby. Chapter 13. Catherine hurried to meet Liam at Cafe Sorrento, but she was almost an hour late. She found him sitting at the bar watching the Bulls and the Lakers. His cocktail glass was nearly empty. "Sorry," she said as she set her purse on the bar and slid onto a stool. "The pretrial conference lasted all afternoon." Turning to the bartender, she said, "I'll have a light beer, please." Liam tapped his glass for a refill. "You could have called." "I'm sorry, I was in Chambers. I came as soon as I could. Anyway, how was your day?"
"Depressing. I spent the whole day looking into the bedeviled life of John Summers. One tragedy after another. I talked to a couple partners in the transactional group and his deceased wife's friend and neighbor Sharon Oberman. He has a sister, Deborah, but she hasn't returned my calls." The bartender brought the two drinks and Liam took a sip of his cocktail.
"So you left a message for Deborah Summers?"
"No. Now she's Deborah Wilson, married to Eugene Wilson. They live in Louisville."
"What did you learn about Summers?"
"Everyone I talk to likes him, and everyone feels sorry for him. And no one is surprised that he left his job. They worry about him."
"Did they think he took the money?"
"I didn't raise that issue with everyone. It's not common knowledge, yet. Walter asked me to keep quiet about the money, at least until the lawsuit is filed and it hits the papers." Catherine took a sip of her beer.
"Does anyone have any idea where he went?"
Liam nodded solemnly. "The general consensus is Brazil. Walter found a receipt for a plane ticket, and the FBI confirmed that Summers was issued a boarding pass for Rio a few hours after the closing."
"Why Brazil? Does he have a connection there?"
"Not that anyone knows of. There's a picture of Summers, his wife, and daughter on a beach that sits on Summers' desk. Could be Brazil. But Walter thinks it's most likely about Brazil's extradition policy. It's almost impossible to get someone extradited from there. So the ticket might make sense. Brazil amended its constitution in 1988 to state, no Brazilian shall be extradited. If he planned all this and applied for Brazilian citizenship, who knows?" Liam shook his head.
"But I don't think that's it.
I think it's more likely the ticket was a diversionary tactic, a misdirection. He might not have gone there at all, but even if he did, he could have gone on to someplace else."
Catherine grabbed her beer and her purse. "I'm starving. Let's get a table."
The owner led them to a corner table covered with a red and white checkered tablecloth. In the center, a straw-covered bottle of Chianti had been converted into a candle holder. They waved off the menus.
"We'll both have the cannelloni special, Tony," Liam said. "Sausages and peppers to start."
Catherine took another sip of her beer.
"So, tell me about your depressing day."
"I started at your old firm. Walter introduced me to Chuck Henderson, who seemed to know John Summers well. They were both transactional attorneys, ate lunch together, sometimes socialized. Summers headed up J&F's business group. He was the practice group chairman."
"I knew Jack was a group chairman. He was appointed to the position before I left. But he worked on a different floor and we didn't cross paths very often. I also remember Chuck. A little overweight, a little thin on top, fighting that middle-aged battle."
Liam nodded.
"Middle age is a formidable opponent. Chuck's losing the war. To quote Charles Barkley, Father Time is undefeated."
Liam tore off a piece of garlic bread and placed it on his plate.
"Anyway, Chuck's a nice fellow who was close to Summers and had a lot of information to tell. As far as Jack's service to the firm, he was a diligent, hard worker. There was never an issue with his professional responsibility or his work product. He was never accused of mismanaging a file or neglecting a matter. He was entirely trustworthy. And Chuck cannot believe he misappropriated any money."
"But?"
Liam shrugged.
"He's gone and the money's gone. As Chuck reluctantly admitted, the inference is compelling. It makes him very sad. He says it's just the cliff at the end of Jack's road."
"What does that mean?"
"It means Jack was in a tailspin. The events in his personal life had devastated him."
"His wife?"
Liam nodded.
"Sharon was a close friend and gave me the Summers family history at her kitchen table. It's a long story."
Catherine opened her hands and raised her eyebrows.
"And?"
"Jack met Alina overseas about 10 years ago.
He was a junior foreign service specialist on assignment for the State Department of Amman, Jordan. She was pursuing an advanced degree in psychology at the University of Jordan. She was also an accomplished pianist, and that's how Jack came to meet her. Helene was performing at the embassy one night with the classical trio. It was a cocktail party for some dignitaries, and Jack was in attendance. According to Sharon, he couldn't take his eyes off her. He was smitten. Sharon showed me pictures, and I don't blame him. Alina was striking. Dark hair, perfect complexion, a Middle Eastern beauty. They were a good-looking couple. Liam paused. She wasn't Jordanian. He wrinkled his brow. Palestinian, I think. Sharon said her family lived in one of the West Bank cities. Anyway, Jack takes a liking to her and hangs around after the concert to ask her out, which, according to Sharon, was a giant step because Jack's a very shy person. He's a Jew, she's an Arab, he's an American, she's a, I don't know, a Palestinian. This is a relationship that's never going to work out, but like Sharon says, he's smitten. So he musters up his courage and asks her if he can call on her. Customs being what they are over there, she won't go out without a chaperone. She's staying with her aunt, Safiya, who lives in Amman, and so the three of them take a walk. Then they go to dinner, and then another dinner, and you get the picture.
I like this story, Catherine said.
I would too if it didn't end so tragically.
Liam reached over and took a healthy share of sausage and peppers off the serving plate.
They dated solidly for the better part of a year. Safiya was their cover. She liked Jack and delighted in the intrigue. Then, in the spring, things began to change. Alina graduated, and Jack was informed that the Foreign Service was going to send him to Turkey. At that crossroads, they decided to get married. Neither of them wanted to move to Turkey, so they decided to move back to the States.
Uh-oh.
Right. Alina hadn't told her parents about Jack. They didn't know she had been dating anyone, let alone an American Jew. And Jack, he wanted to do the right thing. He told Alina he was going to ask her father for her hand in marriage. So the two of them traveled to Alina's home to see the father, naive as can be. Surprise, it did not go well. Liam offered the sausage and peppers plate to Catherine. She took a single green pepper and cut it into small bites. Liam shook his head.
What does Sharon know about Alina's father?
Catherine asked. We didn't talk too much about the father's background. Supposedly, he comes from a very old and respected Arab family. He's a doctor, a prominent man in his community. Alina's family is well-to-do and lives in a large home in some West Bank city.
Must have taken enormous courage for Jack to petition her father.
Without a doubt. But he shows up at the front door with Alina. A manservant shuttles them into this fancy library with marble floors and oriental rugs. A few minutes later, Alina's father comes into the room and asks them to sit down. Not wanting to be rude, Jack waits to be recognized before he starts speaking. The silence is deafening. Finally, Alina's father nods and gestures with his fingers in a rolling motion, as if saying, "You may begin." Jack stumbles with an introduction, tells him how much he loves his daughter, tells him that he and Alina are very much in love and would like to make a life together. He would like his blessings for their marriage. Father nods his understanding. "You are Muslim?" he asks. "No," Jack says. "Actually, I'm Jewish, but I have great respect for your religion, and I would support Alina in the practice of her faith." The father nods again. "Where do you think you will live?" "In Chicago, sir," Jack says, "but I promise that Alina will visit you often as she wants or as you want." Her father listens politely, rests his chin on his hand, nods, pauses, and then calmly announces that Jack is to leave not only the house, but the city. He is never to see Alina again. Alina is forbidden from ever contacting him. Jack tries to reason with him. They are adults and they are entitled to make decisions about their lives. They love each other. Liam shook his head. No dice. In comes the father's manservant, like out of Arabian Nights, and takes Jack by the elbow and walks him out to the street. He says to Jack, "If I see you here again, it will not be good for you. Forget Alina."
But he didn't, did he? Catherine said.
Nope. He goes back to Amman and hopes that Alina's aunt can intercede. Safiya says she has no chance of changing her brother's mind, but Safiya is romantic. She will contact the family and try to bring Alina to Amman where they can see each other again. Weeks go by. Safiya says Alina is being watched and is confined to her home. Finally, Jack is informed that Alina is coming to visit Amman, but she will be chaperoned. Liam paused.
Are you sure you don't want any more of the sausage and peppers? You're missing out here.
No, Liam, tell me what happens next.
Alina arrives at Sophia's, but as expected, she's watched very closely. Jack dares not show his face or Alina will be whisked away. But, as Sharon said with a devilish glint in her eye, Sophia is a romantic and a schemer. She arranges a secret rendezvous for them at the market. The reconnection is stronger than ever, and Jack and Alina vow to be together. There is a recital at the university, and a plot is hatched. Sophia buys tickets for everyone. In the midst of the performance, Alina excuses herself to go to the ladies' room. She dashes out the front door, meets Jack in a taxi, and the two of them hightail it to the airport where they catch a flight to Rome and then to Chicago.
That's so exciting, Catherine said with a broad smile. I almost don't want to hear the tragic part.
The cannelloni was served, and the two ate in silence for a while, commenting only on the superb quality of the pasta.